It's a pleasure to be here this evening. Welcome. I think we're doing some extraordinarily important work tonight, and it has to do with kind of really understanding best practices from a variety of other places that affect our public realm. And affecting our public realm affects who we are as citizens in this region and community. It's an opportunity, as Justin has suggested, to shape the attention of those who will be preparing code against a new land use plan. And that code, form-based code, is, I think, an extraordinary opportunity in a unified development ordinance to bring together a number of themes that the public has brought forward over decades here in Buffalo. So we sit at just the right time, and I think with some of the best talent that we could be sitting with to help us think through that particular dimension of our new form-based code. I'm going to introduce to you quickly these folks who have extraordinary resumes, but I'm going to give you just a few highlights. We have Tavis Dockwiller. Tavis is all about green infrastructure. She's the author of the High Performance Landscape Guidelines for New York City and comes to us from Viridian Landscape Studios in Philadelphia, PA. So you have to ask yourself, how does a tiny little firm in Philadelphia get to write the landscape guidelines for New York City? And the answer is because she's really smart. We go next to Commissioner Gail Dorfman. My notes say she's an elected official, but deep and serious research by me tells me she's the county commissioner at Hennepin County in Minneapolis, Gail. We have Jeff Olson. Jeff? Jeff is a designer. He is the past New York State Pedestrian and Bicycle Program Manager, currently working with Alta Planning and Design, all things bike, at Saratoga Springs in New York. And finally, we have from Washington, D.C., Sam Zimbabwe. Sam is working for the District Department of Transportation in Washington, D.C., and focuses on transit and sustainable development. We've given them a bit of a charge. It's going to be torture. They've got to answer three questions each in sequence, in categories. What are you, nuts? But we're going to make it work. The questions are really very specific. One of them, and the first one I'll start with, and I think we'll start with Tavis, if you don't mind. What is the most innovative initiative around complete streets from your field? And that would be high-performance landscapes and I don't know. You tell us.
Okay, hi. For me, it's really a shift from business as usual to business for the future. As a landscape architect, the big thing that I see people doing and people beginning to understand is to understand that we have to reconnect soils, water, and vegetation into working systems. And when we introduce those systems into complete streets, we can actually manage stormwater much more efficiently, and we can grow the urban forest that we really require for not only all the environmental benefits, but for all the benefits of great neighborhoods that we see. So huge economic benefits when we actually look back in time to how ecosystems used to work and figure out technically how to apply that into our streets today.
So if we take that then to the scale of transportation, let's ask Sam Zimbabwe to address the same question.
First of all, let me say, I go to a lot of community meetings in my job. This is, I think, one of the few that has beer as part of it. So, and is the one of the few in a beautiful setting. Usually, I'm getting yelled at about parking, or things like that. Yeah, exactly. No, I'm later. To expand a little bit on what I do, I'm the associate director for policy and planning for the District Department of Transportation. So we're the city Department of Transportation for all of Washington, D.C. I would say the most innovative thing that I see us doing is actually not necessarily something that's so forward-looking, but it's doing more with less. And we've been hit, as local governments all across the country have been hit by sort of fiscal crises over the last few years especially. And that's meant that rather than saying we can't do everything, we still have to meet a sort of large and growing demand of our citizens, but we have to do it with fewer resources, and that scarcity breeds creativity for us. And so I think that we've been able to, in the last few years, do things with a light touch, sometimes not needing to do the full infrastructure investment, but do something that meets those needs in a short time frame and gets things going to then come back later when we have the resources to do something more fully. I see that's something that departments of transportation are doing all over the place. We don't have to wait for everything to be perfect before we do something good.
Sam, I want to welcome you to Buffalo, where we've been doing more with less for 40 years. Jeff, why don't you pick up the mic and take a shot at this question?
Okay, I thought we were going left.
Most innovative initiative around complete streets.
I'm going to say that I think this evening is one of the most innovative. See, this many people turn out to be talking about complete streets and green infrastructure in Buffalo. You deserve a round of applause. So, and to do it in this great building, this is really fantastic. But being someone who works specifically in the bike and pedestrian part of green infrastructure, to us, I think the thing that's probably the most exciting is the new NACTO guide. I don't know how many people here would be familiar with it, but NACTO, the National Association of City Transportation Officials, has just released an online 3D color graphic-based tool that takes the challenges of creating innovative solutions for bicycling that have happened around the world in places like Minneapolis or Washington, D.C. or Montreal, and have now codified those and documented them in a very easy, user-friendly format that's available for free online to cities all over the United States and around the world. And I hope that Buffalo can take that. You can just go to nacto.org. I think it may be one of the most exciting documents that I've ever been involved in, and the project team that worked on that just really took advantage of the combination of technology, communications, graphics, and did something that probably has pushed things forward maybe a decade. Many of the treatments that people have struggled with and tried to make happen that we see in some of the most progressive cities are not in the manuals in most places in the United States, and now they are. So when somebody says to you, you can't do that because it's not in the manual, you just need to look at the NACTO guide, and in fact it is.
Wonderful. These guys are quick and good. The person who is obviously the smartest at our table is our commissioner from Minneapolis because she came the furthest. Commissioner Dorfman.
There's a setup, and I'm delighted to be here. I'll date myself. The last time I was in Buffalo was in 1960.
It's 1960?
It's 1960, according to my mother. It's changed a lot since then. Most of you weren't born then, but I'm delighted to be back here. When I think about just, and I have to tell you, if you look at Minneapolis and Erie County, you're a lot like, I mean, there's a lot of similarities between Minneapolis and Hennepin County and Buffalo and Erie County, including the weather. And so we have some of the same challenges that we face in terms of implementing complete streets. What I think was really innovative in Hennepin County is when we started approaching this issue about 6 years ago, we did it with money we got from Blue Cross Blue Shield that was totally focused on addressing a growing obesity problem that we had in Minneapolis and the county. Obesity rates had been less than 10% 20 years ago, or less than 10%. Now they were edging closer to 30% of all our residents were considered obese. And so we brought a public health lens to the discussion. And so it wasn't initially, we passed an active living policy, which was about integrated physical activity into daily routines through biking, walking, and transit. It wasn't initially the transportation engineers at the table or the land use planners, it was the public health folks. And so it was an interesting way to sort of look at this, and it made it easier in many ways to engage the public. Because it was really about building healthy communities and building healthy residents in those communities. And our Complete Streets policy came out of that after several years of implementing active living.
It's interesting. It was Dwight Eisenhower once suggested, if you really want to solve a problem, and you can't get it in the nut of it, you make it bigger. So let's take on health and we get the bigger piece. It's a lovely strategy. Thank you. So essentially, in our little warm-up round here, we've got Tavis is going to do something other than business as usual through the integration of soil, water, vegetation in a complete streets program. Again, delivering a larger return than we normally have historically asked of our street infrastructure. Jeff and the NACTO gives us a kind of state-of-the-art, hot-off-the-press set of guidelines, and Gail speaks to us from the standpoint of including other returns from the actions we would take, and Sam reminds us we have to do more with less. I'm now going to ask them to do something that is impossible. I'm going to ask them to situate what they think they know in Buffalo. How can they do that? That's what you do. You all have comment cards. That's your opportunity to take the kind of expertise they're working with and to ask them some questions back, which we'll take advantage of after we get through these first few rounds. But the question I've been asked to pose to our panelists is, what do you see that Buffalo can do that can have the greatest impact in regards to complete streets? So this is a sort of, okay, there's a state of the art. Now, given what you know about us, I guess airport to here, plus the times you've been here before, 1960 now, it's a little different, but not a lot different, less population. Give us your thoughts on what Buffalo can do that can have the greatest impact in regards to complete streets. And let me start, Sam, with you as you speak to the more with less strategy, but still get on with it.
I feel like this is a little bit of a game show here, I think. I don't know if I should answer with a question or if I should answer. I think here's what I think we've been successful at in Washington, D.C., and what I think that a lot of cities have been successful with, is really not being afraid to fail. And I think that means for you in this room to make sure that you support the leaders that put themselves out there to try innovative things. It means taking a leap of faith that when you build something, they will come. That you may have to trust that there is that traffic may get a little bit worse, but more people are going to be able to move along a street. Then you may slow down cars a little bit, but more people will move through a street. I think. So that's one thing, is just not being afraid to fail. We've done a lot of innovative things recently, before my time with DDOT, so I can't take all the credit. The people who work with me have done a lot of innovative things. But we sometimes had to put the paint down and then a month later grind it out and put it back again slightly differently because it wasn't quite working the way we expected it to. So that's not a problem to do that. So don't be afraid to fail. And then I think the other thing is, I walked around. This is my first, I didn't come in 1960. I haven't been here. This is my first time ever to Buffalo. So I wasn't born in 1960. I think one thing, I saw were signs of more and more people living downtown and more of a mix of uses and fewer vacant lots downtown. I think that making sure that there is a vital core of the region is very important for making complete streets happen. And giving people transportation options is enabling people to have choices about where they live and how they get around. So I think continuing to whether it's through city investment, through regional investment, making sure that the core of the community is where the vitality is, really, from a land use perspective, helps the transportation happen.
Thank you, Sam. Let me go to Jeff and ask you to take on that same question. What can Buffalo do that can have the greatest impact in regards to complete streets?
Other than just providing free wings for everyone, I thought that was part of the program tonight. I actually think Buffalo is doing more than maybe we realize. This was the first city in New York State to adopt a complete streets policy, and I was lucky enough to have a chance to work with Justin on that. You were way ahead of the curve, and you're thinking these kinds of things and have been for quite a while. I think the real challenge is how to get more of it implemented quickly so that we don't have to wait as long to see results. And that's really a matter of looking at, as you just said a second ago, that Buffalo's population in the core center city is less than it was, but its infrastructure was built for many more people to be here. So there's a significant amount of extra person capacity on almost every street, which creates the opportunity for a significant amount of road diets and repurposing that space so that it provides for the needs of everyone who needs to be moving in the city of Buffalo, and that's pedestrians, bicyclists, transit customers, and that's just part of a maybe an overlay design. We're working with Pittsburgh right now and actually looking at 35 to 40 road diet candidate projects as part of an overall plan. And I think that's something that Buffalo could really start to do, is take that innovative policy that you've already created, as you are beginning to adopt that into your form-based code, but also look for those early win projects where you do have the opportunity as a result of the very sufficient space that exists on the streets in the city.
Jeff, give us just a short response to, take us to school on road diets. Tell us what they are.
And as, you know, as Gail said, a lot of this comes from the public health realm, and it's one of my favorite terms because it combines public health and public works. The idea being that you can take, in many cases, a classic example of a four-lane street, four-lane cross-section under a certain volume of traffic may work better, safer, and more efficiently if it's a three-lane street. And that's a very common example of a road diet, of less number of lanes for one mode, but greater use of space for the other modes. And the end result is, in effect, a diet for all of us, because we're using the space more efficiently, we're making do with less, as Sam said, but we're also making things move better, which makes us healthier and gets us all on a healthy diet.
Thank you very much. Gail, you want to take it from there?
Sure. Well, as you can imagine, when we started out with a public health focus, and we actually took staff from our public health department and embedded them in the transit department, you can imagine what that reaction was like. They were like, what are those people doing here? So one of the things that you definitely need to do that I think we've been somewhat successful is breaking down those silos, because you can't just have a complete streets policy in a vacuum. It has to be aligned with your land use policies. It has to have the support across a number of sort of business lines within government. And I think that's really, really critical. I also think, and while our mayor of Minneapolis, R.T. Rybak, is a big biking fan, he also does stage diving and other things, but we engaged all the mayors. And it wasn't just the mayor of the largest city in Hennepin County. And so I still remember a video that was really great. These two mayors who'd been mayors forever, I think, from these, at the edge of Hennepin County, from these small rural communities, they challenged one another and each other's community to a step to it challenge to get healthy. And their whole community turned out. It was because the leadership of these two mayors that are both over 70 years of age. And so there was a lot of buy-in from elected officials all throughout small towns, as well as major urban center, that this made sense for the whole region. It wasn't just right for the city of Minneapolis. And that kind of championing it helped sort of break down those silos within government and across different sort of jurisdictional lines, and include the private sector as well, who ended up footing a lot of the bill for a lot of the initiatives that we've done.
Help us understand a little bit the embedded in transit organizations. Who is infiltrating and how?
Well, I mean, literally we took a public health planner who, you know, was doing all those kinds of things about public health initiatives around reducing chronic diseases and things like that. And all of a sudden one day we gave her a desk in our transit department. And we said, she's developing this active living initiative. And she started, I mean, it was great. The first time that she starts telling transportation engineers that they need to look at road diets, that went over really well. But now they are. I mean, one of our transportation engineers said to me last week, our complete streets policy empowers us to do new things and work with our communities in new ways. And so it's a lot of changing the culture and the way sort of that doing business in a different way that Tavis referred to.
Thank you, Gail. Tavis?
Well, people have been hitting on it, but I think it's interagency cooperation. in my work in Philadelphia, in New York, and in New York City, and in Syracuse, New York, where we're working on green overlay projects, we need to have everybody talk. It has to not just be the transportation people and not just the parks people, but also the maintenance people, from parks maintenance to road maintenance. We're asking them to think about things very differently, and together we're trying to find the solutions that can be built, implemented, and maintained over a long period of time. And we're asking, particularly from the maintenance end, for people to rethink maintenance. We need people trained differently and to segue resources differently than we have in the past. I'll give you one, for instance, that I'll talk about again tomorrow. Doing a complete street with a bump-out plan. The plans moved forward. Things got constructed. We didn't have the right engagement with the snowplow operators, and we're actually retrofitting something for them in the field today, because as soon as they saw the work in the field, they realized that they would have plowing problems when they did it. And we didn't realize that they hadn't had that proper engagement, because we don't always see the whole process at my firm. So just having that conversation really has changed things up. If we move forward with things like complete streets and we don't think about long-term maintenance and community engagement, I don't think that they can be successful, because part of the complete street really depends on long-term and community to make sure it remains and is loved. We always say at my firm, if people don't love something, they won't maintain it or care about it. And complete streets really bring so much more back to you in your community, not only traffic movement, ease of movement, but real beauty to the community that becomes very important and very sacred.
Wow. I have this imagination of a snowplow operator, a stormwater management and vegetation planner relative to complete streets, working with a public health official in a transit office, and they're not afraid to take a risk, and they are all moving towards significant road diets.
You know, Dean, if I could just add to Tavis's comments, another example of sort of working across that one of the advantages of working across sort of silos and breaking down these barriers is you're able to identify new opportunities. A sewer project is a complete streets opportunity. It's things like that. What are those opportunities?
And when we tear up the street, can we put some tubes under it and cool and heat our house? Does that work? I like that. Okay.
And if I can add one more thing, that's really the only way we're seeing, well, one of the ways that we're seeing funding come, when we actually combine those initiatives. There's no way from our end. I'd love to wave the magic wand in every city I work in and say, boom, your trees are growing great, your combined sewer overflow problem is done, and your children can get to school on bikes. But the fact is we have this monetary problem, and when we start to talk, we see that start to go away.
Yeah. I have an imagination that this kumbaya moment of all of these disciplines in one operation, doesn't happen very often and doesn't happen very easily. Any insights about how you facilitate that kind of cooperation from any of you?
It's kind of a good segue, because some of my former colleagues in New York State DOT are here. And at the time I worked for the department, I was one person. And we realized that the only way to be successful is to get lots of people involved. And I think the answer to that is that this is a topic right now that you'll be surprised that there's somebody in every agency, in every organization, that has been waiting a long time to do exactly these kinds of things. And putting those kinds of teams together is something we do on almost every project that we're involved in, whether it's the team that's working on planning and designing the project or the advisory groups that work in helping to facilitate moving the projects forward. And it's a very exciting part of what's happening, is that you will find in almost every case that team has just been waiting to come together and is really looking, and it's people that, it's the health department person, it's somewhere in the water and sewer department. We were just working on a project where a gas pipeline company that had just become one of the advisory board members realized they were about to put a pipeline right through an area where this particular complete streets project was supposed to happen. And they're excited to do the work. As a company, they saw that as an opportunity to make themselves look like great corporate citizens in their community. So I think don't be shy about that. It has tremendous potential. I think you're already working on that a lot here with the health community in Buffalo, and I think it's an open door to move projects forward.
And is it the experience of the panel that you see these teams in many cities across the country?
Yes, although there's still absolutely a lot of discussions between agencies about whose money is going to do it and how the money is going to do it. But the important thing is that the conversation is starting for all of these things.
And there are funding, if you look outside the box, there are funding opportunities to do these things too. For example, we're now updating our countywide bike plan, but also doing a ped plan for the first time. And a number of our cities are doing bike ped plans. And it's all being funded by the Center for Disease Control.
So make the team and expand the return on investment argument to include that broader cross-section, whether it's geothermal or sewer or road diets or bike and pedestrian ways within those diets. Terrific. Now it comes where I think that the audience and you can have perhaps the best interaction. You have a group of people here who like their beer, for sure, but are clearly here on purpose relative to a role they play in action and advocacy. They work hard and long hours trying to make happen some of the things you're describing, often from outside the system, sometimes from within the system. But overall, what do you say to an audience like that about what their job is to get on with the kind of responses you've given us so far about what constitutes the best practice, or at least the one you think might be the best in your area? And then secondly, the kind of ways in which we might bring it to ground here in Buffalo, at least operationally. But then what's the role of citizen advocates and interested citizens such as we have here tonight? And I'll just ask each of you to offer a comment on that as you feel inclined to pick up the mic. Or not.
It was a long question. Maybe I'll start from the end of it, which is what can the citizen advocate do and sort of work backwards. I would say the most important thing I joined local government 6 months ago after a time. About 5 years working in national advocacy and working with communities around the country around mostly around transit-oriented development, but around complete streets and things like that. And I'd say that in my 6 months, the most important thing that helps me do my job better is informed advocacy from the outside. And that is a community that holds us accountable for following through on our promises as an agency and also supports us when we do a good job. And I'll give an example of something that happened to us as an agency. Last year, we fell way short on our goals of installing bicycle facilities. We had a goal of, I think it was, our goals were around eight miles a year of bike lanes. We had planned out about five, but we got a bit mired in internal issues, and we did less than a mile. And it was the first time in 10 years we had done that little as an agency. And the Washington Area Bicyclists Association put out a blog post. And these are advocates that we work with. We actually fund them to do certain things. And they did a blog post which held us accountable and said, why is the agency falling short of its stated goals? And that caused us and caused our director to say, why are we getting this bad press? Why are we getting, what's going on? What's failing? Get it done. So that sort, it wasn't lobbing bombs. It wasn't going to the mayor and complaining. It was putting out very informed, very thoughtful commentary on why we were falling short. And it meant that we didn't get defensive immediately, but we tried to look at the solution. That helped us pick up the pace, and now we've installed those 5 miles from last year, and we're moving forward much quicker on all of our projects for the coming year. So I think that's a very difficult skill to have, but being that informed advocate, supporting leadership, but holding them accountable, and then I think following on what Jeff said earlier, that there are leaders everywhere, and that everybody throughout, it doesn't have to be writing a blog that's the leadership in this, but it could be people within their current jobs, talking to your neighbors about it, all those sorts of things, that type of organizing that helps build popular support for these types of things.
There's an interesting dichotomy that some would frame in the recommendation, which is to support leadership and hold them accountable. It's a pleasure to hear a public servant ask for both. Thank you.
I'm going to pick up on that by saying inventory what's right and look for the low-hanging fruit. When we're asked to help a city or just a homeowner to figure out what's right for them in getting back to ecology, understanding natural systems, figuring out how they can change the world around them, the first thing that we usually do is look for what's right and look for what's the easiest thing to do first to make the situation immediately better. I'm sure if you went through Buffalo, you would find lots of things that are right within Buffalo, and it's important to look at those and make a baseline for where you are today so you know where you are in 5 years. It's educating yourselves and also educating others, of course. And it's also for us, we always have to figure out what people know and what they don't know. Sometimes we make assumptions in my field that we know what's right and we know everything that's good, but in fact, when we begin to have this sort of embedded conversation, we figure out a lot of our ideas were wrong and we actually really do need to listen to the road engineers because we don't want people flattened like pancakes and we have to make some sort of a conversation happen so we get all of our needs met. And the final one for me is what I tell my staff all the time, know people. I love email, I love technology, I love everything we can do, but at the end of the day, if you don't know the person at their desk, it's really hard to influence them to do something differently or think differently.
So it's not just the blog attack or the email blitz, there's a face-to-face component. Help us with some examples of easiest first. What are you thinking about when you say that?
Don't cut down your mature trees to make complete streets.
That's easy. Or not.
Yeah. And tomorrow, for those of you who will be there, I'm going to show an example of that, where we were trying to do a complete street. We were trying to make a big stormwater capture to solve combined sewer overflow within Syracuse. And God bless our engineers. They came back to us with the plans, and all the mature trees were gone so they could install the catchment pieces. They're good guys, they're really, really smart guys, and we said, listen, can we think about this differently? And because it seems sort of a shame to take the largest stormwater pumps and the most beautiful thing on the street and get rid of it. And they said, we don't think we can do it, and together we found a solution that works really, really well. So there's the...
So work around the mature trees, I got that. What's another example?
Another example.
I would say do it with paint.
Say it again.
Do it with paint.
Do it with paint.
Don't feel like you
do
have
it with
to,
paint.
Yeah. Oh. Do those low cost improvements that you know the road diet that doesn't move the curbs at all but just reallocates the road space. And you know I think one thing that we now in DC have a lot of bike lanes. So people know what they are. People really, that's not the question. But now when we try to do more innovative things, when we try to make protected bike lanes, those types of things, we make people nervous again, and people need to say, I need to see it before I believe it's going to work. And I think that's true no matter where. That's sort of natural human nature. And whether it's trying it here or taking people who are skeptics to go to other places to see how they've done it, Seeing is often believing, and so figuring out a way to do it in a demonstration way to start something is very important.
Great. Jeff, I wonder if you could pick it up from there and talk to us about the strategies that Alta uses to engage citizen groups in bike planning.
It's a great question, and it's also one of the things that's the most enjoyable about what we get to do, because in almost every neighborhood, on every street, there are people who want to see this change happen. I'm just curious, how many people here have a particular street in mind when you're listening to this topic tonight? Just show your hands. Look at this, everybody does. Okay, So if the question was what should everyone do, and I can never say what anyone should do, but what could everyone do, I would encourage you to make that street your personal project and find a way to work together on the issues that are citywide. You're probably going to have some of your parts of your organization that are helping communicate, writing the blog, dealing with your elected officials. But at the ground level, if every one of you adopted that street that you're thinking of right now and made sure that that became a complete street over the next several years, this will be a much, much better community as a result. And part of doing that becomes, to some extent, practicing what we preach. I walked over here tonight. I walked in from the train station just so I could walk through downtown Buffalo and see what we're talking about again. And the things that you see by practicing what you preach, and that's the right metaphor, talking about preaching, and I think we're singing to the choir. We've got every possible metaphor here in this great building tonight. But when you do practice that, and it's part of what you become in your day, and other people see you and recognize you for that. My daughter likes to joke that every person on a bike in my town, I know. I don't think that's entirely true, but when you're out there and experiencing the things that you're talking about, and other people become part of that, it really does transform your community. So be part of the change that you want to see in the world. I'm not the first person to have said that. And adopt your street and your community and take leadership for that project, and you'll make tremendous change happen.
All right, let me just challenge you on that, and again, ask the other panelists to weigh in as well. What do we got, 150 people here? I suppose if you start with paint, you could do 150, but if you get the next level, you've got a question of priorities or strategic intent, or some things in some streets might be more important than others. Right. How do you keep the coalition together and deal with strategies that link those things together in a way that makes sense?
Well, and I guess you're asking, I'm a recovering architect, so I have no patience. I want to see things get built. But I do think there's a planning component here, and the city's in the process of doing that, of having that plan in place where you have identified the sort of early win projects that you know you can do quickly. There may be things that you can do citywide or area-wide that are not specific to individual streets, whether it's tree planting or the art bike racks that you've already been doing or benches or other elements that are part of the streetscape, restriping crosswalks on a neighborhood-wide level, traffic calming projects that may not be necessarily tied to individual specific streets, education and encouragement and promotion programs, radar detection to manage speed. There are a lot of things that you can begin to do right away that are not the most costly thing. And I would actually challenge the comment about things costing money. I think that we can integrate what we're talking about into the annual paving program that the city does. You can make sure that as other capital projects are going on, the streets that you're looking at can get done well. And I encourage you to take a look at a much bigger picture of what gets spent, not just in this city, but in this state and this country. We do tend to spend lots of money on lots of things. We could get a lot of complete streets done if we reallocated our thinking about what it's most important to be spending and investing in our communities.
Terrific. Let me push you one more notch, and again, I'll ask the others to weigh in, because it's an experience we've all had at different times as planners and architects in our life. If you're pushing a certain agenda that's good for your street, and it causes grief to the neighbors on the other street, I'm sorry, you live on an arterial, mine's a residential street, I'm going to push traffic onto the arterial, the hell you say, how do you have that conversation and hold the coalition together?
I think it does. I would agree with. I'll push back on you because I'll agree with Jeff a little bit that it does. It does end up being about a planning. The need for larger plans than just one street, and thinking about how it all fits together as part of a network. And we in DC have done a lot of our low hanging fruit. We've done our easy wins. We've done the road diets where there's really no objections to them. And now we have to make some of those harder trade-offs. And we're actually about to launch a long-range multimodal plan for the city, looking out 25 years, but trying to integrate all of these different modes. And right now we have a bike plan, we have a ped plan, we have a streetcar master plan to build 37 miles of streetcar, we have a bus plan, we have all these different plans. And often, as we look at them, they all speak for the same street. So one street might be a priority bike route, a priority streetcar corridor, a priority pedestrian corridor. And that's difficult. It's difficult to accomplish every goal within every street, and so that really starts to speak to the need to look at a network. And I think that that doesn't preclude what Jeff's exhortation about make your street that your project, because through that process you're going to work all of that. I have no fear that you guys can all work that out. If there are people who take ownership of their street, but do that in that informed advocacy sort of framework, you're going to make good decisions together as a group.
So the solution, and I love the answer. The solution is to plan it. What a concept!
But don't plan for planning's sake. Still get that paint and start painting.
There's an interesting dynamic here, which is looking after your street, looking after the neighborhood, and sort of capturing both of those things at once and holding them in your head at the same time. There's also the dimension of once you do that, recognizing it's never no, it's never not this one, it's when. And so in the sequence, you start to map it out. I was impressed, Gail, in your resume to hear about working to expand the light rail transit system in the Twin Cities metropolitan region. I mean, putting a project of that scale in the same place as the obesity project must be an interesting life.
Well, not really, because right next to the new LRT trail that we're planning is a bike trail that's been there for a while. You know, it's an old railroad line. And we're taking advantage of that to have both transit and a bike ped corridor. But I do, in terms of, I'm interested in listening to this. So how do you get, I mean, I remember the first time a bike trail project came into the Twin Cities, and it was going to go out into Minnetonka, which is a fairly, you know, well-off community, and they were totally opposed to it. You know, we don't want, you know, those people coming out here. And it's going to raise, you know, I don't want people, this is going to lead to crime and all those things. And we fought through that. And it took a long time, and then we got it. The first 4-to-3-lane conversion we did, huge sort of infighting, because it meant that some of the business owners were going to lose their parking spaces. And that, of course, was a huge deal for them. Took years to do it. But once that first bike trail was in, once the first 4-to-3 conversion was done, and people actually can go see it and kick it and understand how well it works, and that it's safe and that they get to benefit from it, if you do enough of those, you get to this tipping point where you have a number of people start to say, instead of saying, not in my backyard, they say, we want that too. And it's great because businesses are our allies in this. I mean, they get that these kind of pedestrian bike amenities, access to transit amenities, it's good for business. It's good for their employees. It helps recruit and retain employees. And so you start to get that sort of tipping point where everybody goes, this is really a good thing. And then the challenge is figuring out how you queue it up, because it costs a lot.
Terrific. Thank you, Gail. I think we're at the end of my three questions that I've been asked to sort of push through. I'd like to give you each one chance now to shape the text and direction of what we call the Green Code. This deals with, oh yeah, there's a whole new reframing of 50 to 60 years of an old land use plan and conventional code. A complete transformation to a form-based code. 3,000 citizens have been working on the mapping and the local intelligence demanded by that, right down to this street, thank you very much, like this. It's very clear, very articulate, a very well-informed public. We're now just beginning to write the narrative that supports that code, particularly around the subject in a document that's largely a philosophical document about complete streets right now. It's very tough to enforce without that kind of regulatory structure of the code. So if you were going to aim that piece of work, advise our team and our municipal support group that's working hard on this. Whoever wants it. Wasn't one of our three questions.
We weren't prepped for that one.
We've only begun on the not in your question list.
I I'd say I don't think it's as hard as you present it. I think it's a question of trusting the work that you've already done and starting to build it. I think, you know, I'll go back to something I said earlier, which is just to have faith that it is going to work. And you know, whether it's reducing parking requirements or, you know, enforcing other aspects that developers might say they can't make work. Everybody, you know, figuring out how to make those things happen and you're sort of going from that planning stage to the implementation stage is figuring out how you're going to, you know, whether it's finding ways to invest resources or divert resources into implementing that plan. You know, I think that it's where the demand is coming from, and there is a sort of untapped market everywhere for walkable, livable communities, and trusting that is out there is really important.
That's very reassuring. I heard at least 12 people sigh and relax a little bit when you said it's really not that hard. I like that.
But it sounds like you're doing the right thing. I mean, anytime you do any kind of major visioning or major sort of strategic plan like that, if you engage the public up front, while that takes longer, and you have to listen to everybody, and while not everybody is going to be happy with everything in the plan, it gets you that buy-in because the process was right. So it sounds like you're doing that. I mean, it's kind of like complete streets. I mean, I'll go out and talk to groups and give them an example of a complete street, and there's invariably somebody really, really smart in the room that goes, no, that's not a complete street. You haven't done this and this. There's no bike lane there. I mean, and you have to remember, just like any other big plan, it's not with complete streets. It's not, you know, all modes on all roads. And so it's a balancing act. I give the city a lot of credit and the mayor a lot of credit for wanting to tackle this. It's a huge task, but I would think that everybody would be pretty proud of themselves when it's done, too.
Jeff, you want to try?
I want to respond in a bit of a historical context because, I mean, especially sitting in this room tonight, this is a city that has had the involvement of the Olmsteds and Lewis Sullivan and Frank Lloyd Wright and has built some of the great masterpieces of the built environment in the world. And don't cheer, that's not me, that's they did that, right? If you can build from those bones and build into what the next generation is going to be, then you are absolutely on the right path for this to be an even greater city. And I think that really the opportunity for Buffalo is to see itself in that light. We may have had some years in the last couple decades since the last time Gail was here that might not have built on that tradition, but I am, and I guess maybe some of you probably heard my good friend Jim Kunstler talk about his view of the world, and Jim and I strongly disagree, and always have, because he accuses me of being optimistic and hopeful. And I do believe that next generation of what cities are going to be is happening right now. We're seeing it happen in cities all over the country and around the world. And it is the opportunity of this generation right now to build green, to be sustainable, to create that next economy. And what you're talking about doing is the foundation for making that happen. So I think the only thing I would say is you can't do it fast enough. Get it done, get moving, start making this stuff happen as quickly as we possibly can.
Terrific.
I'll try to follow that. It's great to have planning documents. And when you start doing, you'll see that some of your planning wasn't quite right. And it's exactly like painting the lines and trying it out, or putting planters in before you revamp a whole street, trying out bump outs with planters and paint. You might have to redo a few things along the way. Don't be afraid to redo a few things. Remember the dream and the big goals that you had of getting to the complete streets and what you were trying to accomplish. I come from the land of the Quakers, and they say don't let the perfect get in the way of the perfectly good. So keep it moving forward, and you'll get somewhere, because if you get too bogged down, it can't move.
Lovely. In the final analysis, the instructions to this group is something on the order of support and hold accountable. It's a version of trust and verify. There's a kind of a an even greater city agenda. There's an encouragement to hang on to the optimism that brings you here tonight, because why else would you come if there wasn't some hope for making this work? Pick the low-hanging fruit, sorry for the metaphor, but it works in this context since we're going to vegetate the street, and know your people. Overall, what I think I'm reading across this spectrum is it really isn't all that hard. It just takes a kind of will in the citizenry and an ability to follow the process of supporting and holding accountable as we move step by step. It's now my privilege to introduce to you our moderator for the question and answer session, where we'll take your cards and work from them. And this is Daniel Robison, who's a reporter with the WNED and WBFO. Daniel, over to you.
Hello. Like Robert said, I'm Daniel from WBFO. Thanks. We got a lot of questions, so we huddled in the back and tried to identify themes because I don't think we can get to all of them. But earlier, one of you said that this felt like a game show. So consider this the rapid fire round. We want to get to as many of these as we can and not keep people from the beer for too long. So first off, we have, how do we encourage the private sector to contribute to complete streets? We've talked a lot about city, county, but can the private sector play a role?
Well, I mean, I touched on that. I mean, I think more and more businesses are seeing it, that it's their advantage. In Minneapolis, all the businesses in the city are downtown are required to have bike storage, for example, and the city also contributes to paying the cost for them. There are also, we have 116 Nice Ride kiosks, bikes that people can take and ride to meetings or use whatever they want for. The city's contributed to that, but it's a very strong public-private partnership that has allowed those Nice Ride sharing bikes to happen. So I think the business community gets that they're part of this and that, you know, a complete street community is good for their businesses too. And so they seem very willing, at least my perspective is they seem very willing to help front some of the costs for paying for some of the infrastructure.
I'd say that there's several different scales at which the private sector can be engaged. I think from the from the citywide, from the sort of infrastructure side, as Gail mentioned, I think that engaging the business improvement districts or sort of associations of businesses to take on management of streets or management of different activities, and then down to the individual business owners, how can you get them excited about installing a bike rack? Or you know, San Francisco has had tremendous success recently with this, I forget what it's called now, but it's they've allowed businesses to occupy parking spaces, parking day, but it's sort of permanent parking day now. I forget, they changed the name slightly for the permit, right? Parklets. You know, that's a way to engage the business community in making those, in making streets for everybody. So I think that there's a wide range from the sort of large scale to the small scale. I think at the largest scale, in talking about resources, every community that I know of that has raised revenues for whether it's transit investment or street improvements or things like that has done that in partnership in a political campaign that involves the business community. I think often engaging the business community around infrastructure needs is actually a pretty easy sell. The business community likes infrastructure as well. And so whether it's a sales tax referendum or something like that that raises revenues to deal with the scarcity issue, where there is the need for revenue, that's also a really important place to engage the business.
One of you earlier said to make each project your personal project or make each street your personal street. How do people actually get on the agenda? I mean, it's one thing to go to a meeting and, you know, try to pull aside a legislator afterwards, but how do you get that on, how do you get construction happening for your personal project? Anybody?
It's actually a really great topic because different communities have different processes, but the city does have a capital program where it's known what's going to get repaved every year. The real key to that is getting inside that process before a project's been designed, before the process has moved forward. The last thing you want to do is get out there when they're doing the work out in the street. So you really need to get involved early. In many cases on bigger projects, it's a long-term process, and you have to be patient and stay with it. In some cases, as Buffalo is doing, you're beginning to change the guidelines that shape those projects so you can begin to shape them across the city at once. But it's really a matter of learning how that process works and then having within the planning and development process in the community a way for citizens to have that kind of input. One of the women that works in our company actually wrote a guideline for Fairfax County, Virginia, on how to work with the Department of Transportation in layman's terms. And it actually described the entire process. This would be a great thing for Green Options or one of the local organizations here to put out, and it could easily be done online. So you do understand how that process works. Is a project in your community coming up, or you would like there to be one? How do you begin to enter into that process? Is it state-funded? Is it a city project? Is it a public-private partnership? Is it something that might be area-wide and isn't just limited to specific streets? So that all that is, so you understand that process is transparent and you have a chance to participate in it.
Heard we have a group of high schoolers here this evening. I'm not sure where they are. But we had two youth-oriented questions. First is, have any of your projects incorporated youth in the planning process? And this probably went on something Gail said, but the synergy between Complete Streets and health, is there a connection with education and job opportunities, something that youth would probably be concerned about?
Absolutely. We've been very lucky to work with several schools and universities, so everything from elementary schools up through universities, to talk about green initiatives, not always particular to Complete Streets. But I'll tell you, it is much easier to work particularly with elementary school kids because they have all the greatest ideas. They really get environmentalism on a very basic level. That's the level you need to have it at. And they come up with the greatest ideas that are unburdened by all of the can't-dos, won't-dos, lawyer tells me I shouldn't do of the world. And so I think we should keep looking back because kids know how it is and they tell it exactly how it is.
So I'll just briefly say two things. One, in a lot of the work we've been doing around developing our policies, we've had some focus groups with young people. And they're really, really clear about how they want to live in the future. And they don't want that, you know, single-family home on the cul-de-sac with no access to transit in the suburbs. They want transit-oriented development. They want to bike as much as they can. They want access to all of those pedestrian, biking, transit opportunities. So they're really, really clear about that. The other thing that we've done, and I think you're right about elementary school, we've done a number of biking, walking workshops with schools because kids have said, I can't safely, I live three blocks from school or five blocks or whatever, and I can't safely get there on my bike. And so we've done some really interesting workshops with the kids to figure out what are the complete street elements that we need to implement so they can walk and bike to school more easily.
I'll just add, a couple things really quickly. We've done a range of different things from when we built a trail that went near a school, engaging with the school to help do the planting and maintaining the landscaping right around the trail. We're building our first streetcar line for 50 years in the next year, and we're locating the maintenance facility on the campus of a high school, which will potentially provide opportunities for those students to integrate technical education with potential job opportunities, maintaining and keeping the streetcars up and running. And we also do a lot of work, sort of internship type of opportunities, bringing people in early. And I think it actually goes back to the previous question about how do you engage citizens and sort of educating people at the earliest stage about this complex process that Jeff talked about is really important. And a lot of cities have done, whether it's by nonprofit organizations or by the public sector or in partnership, sort of citizen transportation academies to help people understand this myriad and complex way that we fund transportation over 6 years, and it's this bucket of money and that, and really it's a sometimes we erect those walls to make it easier to keep people out, but understanding that those processes is really important.
Just one more comment. In addition to Complete Streets, there's a sizable national program going on called Safe Routes to Schools, and if you're not currently involved in that, please just go online and look at the National Safe Routes to Schools Coalition. Fantastic way to combine community planning, the need for families and children and staff to be able to get to and from our schools, and many of the solutions that come out of those efforts are Complete Streets. And I just want to add one small connection, that when you think about how a generation changed its habit from an addiction to tobacco and smoking to living a healthier lifestyle, I would argue that it's almost the same level of effort that's going to happen to kick our addiction to fossil fuels. And in order to do that, it's going to be the same way. My parents stopped smoking because their kids were the ones that told them to stop doing it. My kids are the ones now, I see the same comment about this next generation. I hope that if all the kids that are here tonight and the families here tonight, that it's this generation of children that are going to show the people who are older than them how it's done right. And if we listen to them, we'll build a better world.
Tavis, I think this is for you. An audience member wants to hear more about urban forests. What does that mean? How do you do it? And what are the associated benefits?
Oh, how long you want to talk? Well, for me, urban forests are more than just about having nice trees to look at within a city. They're about all the associated climate change that goes with it. In Buffalo, I know you treasure your warm days. In Philadelphia, our days are way too warm, and the urban forest really helps to mitigate extremes in temperature, which it would for you here too, providing shelter in the winter and cool in the summer. We, at my firm, look at a lot of research. It is all going absolutely out of my head, telling you where you should go on the internet. But there are a number of programs through, I think, American Trees and Davy Trees that talk about what the urban forest is and how to obtain canopy cover. We are really linking canopy cover with stormwater and a return to the natural water cycle to solve combined sewer overflow. The more trees, the bigger water pumps you have, the more evapotranspiration you have, so the less stormwater that actually runs off into your rivers and lakes very quickly. I hope that's a brief.
Let me jump in, too. So we at the District Department of Transportation have a whole administration that's urban forestry. So we integrate trees and tree planting into every project that we do. And we have programs. We have something called the Canopy Keepers Program, where people can adopt a tree and water, you know, commit to watering a new tree until it gets on its feet. We encourage both public tree planting and tree planting in private space. We have a permit requirement. If you're going to cut down any tree that has a circumference greater than 42 inches, you have to get a special permit from us to do that, even on private space. And we've been able to document an increase in our tree canopy over the past, I think we just did an update, so we've continued to grow our tree canopy, and that can help document things. I mean, we're under an EPA mandate to reduce our stormwater runoff, so we can help address those things, which we would otherwise have to spend money on bigger and bigger drains and things like that by planting trees and things like that. Vitally important.
Since Complete Streets was passed about 4 years ago now, we've seen some big projects here in Buffalo, Porter Avenue, Richmond. These are streets you probably don't know, but these are a big deal, and they cost a lot of money, but they added bike lanes and a lot of other infrastructure. In terms of doing little things like low-hanging fruit that was mentioned before, like sharrows, you know, what keeps cities from just painting sharrows on roads, on all of its roads? What prevents little measures like that from happening?
I think we're all just shaking our heads. I'll just jump right into that. I go back to something I said earlier about the choices we make about the things that we invest in. And the things you're talking about, whether it's shared lane markings or better crosswalk markings or planting street trees, in the big scheme of things, these are not the most expensive things we're going to deal with. Add to that list some bike racks, some benches, and a handful of other elements that are, they're not amenities. They're critical elements for the distance that I walk today. If I'm coming from the train station to my hotel, if it were my parents wanting to do that walk, they would have needed to rest somewhere. And there was no, there were no benches, right? They'd need shade during the summer. They would need to be able to safely cross the street. If we're going to make it possible for more people to walk and bike and to use transit, we have to make it easier for most people to do. And if we don't, we sort of suffer the death of a thousand cuts for not having done those little things right. Now, just one good example of a kind of program that's been done in many cities throughout the U.S., a spot maintenance program, where an allocation of resources is put into a common pool that then if a community or a neighborhood needs, say, a crosswalk put in front of their school, it's under a certain dollar threshold, painting the crosswalk markings just need to get redone. It comes from those spot maintenance improvements. So you don't have to invest in figuring out what all of them are all at once, but you set up a resource and a crew that can go out and deliver those almost on demand. And you'll find in a program like that, you can implement dozens and dozens and hundreds of small things that add up to improve walkability and bikeability in your community.
There's a second part to that question. Do sharrows work? You know, I don't know how big they are, but do they make an impact on people's attitudes?
Yeah, we actually, it's a good segue. We Segway's part of this tonight?
No. only in the street, on the sidewalk.
That's right. Sharrows or shared lane markings or the sort of bicycle and arrow combination. And Alta did the research that San Francisco used to first begin to implement those. They are, in fact, now in the manual, and you can use those. Are they effective? Yes, but under the correct conditions. And this is like saying, are crosswalks effective? You know, you can't just go out and mark a crosswalk, and that's the only thing you do, and expect it to be safer. You've got to think about signage and visibility and other things. And sharrows work well under certain kinds of streets, certain relationships of speed between the motorists and the bicyclists, where it's comfortable for sharing the road, and generally that's lower speed streets, often in places where there's on-street parking. So I wouldn't, it's like anything else, I don't think just go out and do one thing and do it everywhere. There's a right solution for every street. It takes an eye for detail and a good vision of what you want to accomplish, but it is not one size fits all.
So I'll just say that I shook my head at the question and said, no, there's nothing that's stopping us. And literally, I think there is very little that would stop the implementation of complete streets anywhere. I 10 years ago now, just about, started working on a project with the Congress for New Urbanism, working with the Institute for Transportation Engineers on a manual for major urban thoroughfares. New street design for major urban thoroughfares. And at the beginning of that project, because ITE was going to sponsor it, they said everything has to fit within the AASHTO Green Book, the Bible. And we looked at it and we said, okay, we can fit everything that we want to do from a urban street, walkable, bikeable street perspective into what's allowed within that guidebook. There's nothing that has to be changed about engineering standards to make streets walkable and bikeable. It's how you interpret those standards and the leeway within them that sometimes gets us in trouble. And so I think that there really isn't anything that would stop us from a professional practice perspective from making solutions that work in the context, as Jeff mentioned. We've actually had an issue with sharrows recently in D.C. where people have come into our office and said, I don't understand what these sharrows are. We started putting them down in a lot of places. I don't understand what these sharrows are. Can I not drive on them anymore? What am I supposed to do? So sometimes when you do introduce new things, you also have to introduce some education, and we've found that. We have to make a two-pager. What is a sharrow, and what are you supposed to do as a motorist, as a bicyclist, you know, to help people understand how to use these types of things?
So maybe I can add. I mean, you can implement a lot of complete streets, and some of it is cost neutral. A fair amount of it costs money. And so one of the things that we've done is we looked at our cost participation policy that we have with the cities. So it used to be that if we were reconstructing or even doing mill and overlay on a county road through a community, if the city wanted sidewalks, they had to pay the entire cost. And now we've changed our cost participation policy because of Complete Streets. So now if they want a sidewalk, we'll pay 25% of those costs. And if they're willing to put in a bike ped trail, we'll pay 50% of those costs. So there's some incentive to do it right, too.
All right, we have time for one more question. This one says, Buffalo is a very economically and ethnically diverse community. How can we use these principles to create a better sense of community amongst all the people of Buffalo?
Well, I mean, again, I think it comes down to a conversation. When you talk to people, often they really want the same things at the end of the day: communities that are safe, communities that they can live in, that they can walk in, that they can get their needs met in. One of the things that my son says about where we live in Philadelphia is, it's so great, Mom, we can walk here and we can get anything we need right here. Again, hearing from the little kid, he ignores that some of the streets look pretty beaten up and maybe the gas stations aren't so great right down the block. I just think people have common goals for what they need. You see in different levels of economics that one thing might be more important than another. In some neighborhoods we go in, and the first thing that's really important to them is that their streets are safe because their lights are out. So you have to pinpoint those first efforts to get people to understand the whole that you're moving toward. But I think everyone really is moving toward the same whole.
And I'd add that, so in Washington, D.C., I think about 35% of households don't own a car. And those are both young, affluent people who choose not to own a car and low-income families that can't afford a car. And when we make opportunities for people to get around not using a car, we're helping all of those people. We're helping reduce everybody's transportation costs by making it, and that makes their money go farther. So if somebody can get to a job without needing to get in a car, that's going to make their income go farther. That gets recircled throughout the community rather than going to whoever owns the gas station. So I think that there's a lot of ways that Complete Streets help bring people together from an economic and a social perspective. One thing that's often a challenge is Tavis mentioned that, you know, sometimes it's about streetlights, not about bike lanes in communities. Again, Washington, D.C., we're a pretty segregated city still in large parts, and one of the biggest obstacles to low-income households walking and biking is getting across the Anacostia River. This point. And our connections across the river are terrible for bikes and peds. And so we can do all we want installing bike lanes and things like that, but people won't be able to actually get to where they need to go. Or they might get to transit and then take transit someplace. But people won't be able to get to where they need to go for jobs, for things like that, if we can't make those cross-river connections better. So I think it's a constant struggle to make equitable transportation investments throughout a city that's diverse and has different needs. But that's something that we need to figure out how to make those investments, again, with the right context and meeting communities' needs, but throughout the city.
I mean, I found something really interesting happen. In some of our more affluent communities, we actually meet some of the biggest resistance because they really like how their community looks, and they don't see great ways for things to change. And often there's a lot of political will within those communities to be resistant. When we go into less affluent neighborhoods, people are so overjoyed by any little change that they get because someone paid attention and gave them something that we see a lot of care being given toward it. So I was really surprised by that as I've gone through my career, because often we're taught that it's going to be very difficult the more the economics get very difficult. There's a study done on the greening of Harlem where the person who was largely responsible for the beginning of that movement said, we have to give people really beautiful places because that's what they crave, and if we do that, everything will change. And that's exactly what we see.
So this is just a little point, but and I know you guys are doing this here, but we've been doing under Active Living and Complete Streets, and we've been funding them, a number of events. The Step to It Challenge that I mentioned, which was a competition amongst our cities. The Workplace Wellness Initiative, where we're encouraging private employers to initiate wellness programs, active opportunities for their employees. We've been doing bike rodeos for kids. We've been doing Ciclovia events where we close down a road on Sundays. And a number, my favorite is the, what did they call it? I wrote it down because I love this, and I remember seeing it when, Babes in Bike Lands, the largest all-female alley cat race in the country. There you go. In any case, but what's really amazing when we do this is that neighbors come out and meet neighbors for the first time, often. And they love these community sort of festivals and events around biking and walking. And so, you know, you bring them out and you start to, I mean, it's a great way to sort of publicly educate people about the benefits of, you know, biking and walking and creating communities that provide those amenities.
I'll just add to that that, you know, the whole question of equity in our society, when you look at it in terms of mobility and transportation, is pretty extraordinary. When you think about it, we've spent probably 90%+ of our infrastructure money for decades on modes of transportation that only a small segment of our population can actually use. If you were to create a, if I had PowerPoint here, I'd have two pie charts for you. One is the current amount of spending in, let's say, New York State or the United States. If you took a pie chart and cut it in half, you'd have half of it spent in New York State on transit, half of it spent on highways, right? What's left on the knife after you cut the pie in half is what we spend on walking and bicycling. Okay, that's what we get for the mode of transportation that is the most commonly used in the world, is the crumbs that are left over from the pie chart. Walking, ultimately, everyone is a pedestrian. Everyone, in every community, everywhere we live, every trip that we take, starts as human beings walking. Okay, and as much as we'll talk about bicycling and transit and everything else, the most equitable thing we could do is make a greater investment in that form of transportation, which everyone can share and use. And that cuts across communities I've worked in, from inner city Cleveland, where we worked on an eco-village project, to here in Buffalo, Detroit, countries in other parts of the world. We're working on favela projects now in Rio in advance of the Olympic Games, because no one has invested in these forms of transportation. We've left them sort of on their own. And I think you will find here in Buffalo and really everywhere that it is that common denominator that makes us all human, is the fact that we walk. And so we should start our investments at the level of the pedestrians first, and then everything else will work from there.
Just an item of encouragement regarding the same conversation is that whenever someone says to you strategic, you really have to follow up with the question, toward what end? And if the answer isn't in some fashion just, inclusive, the greatest good for the greatest number, then it's probably not as strategic as whoever offered it thinks it is.
All right, sorry we didn't get to everybody's questions, but I'm sure the panelists would love to talk to you afterwards. Came a long way, so if you want to ask them something, feel free to do that. I want to mention, before you get back to the food and the alcohol, we're going to host this event on our website, wbfo.org, so you can stream it, send it to your friends, perhaps. But let's give a hand for our panelists.
Thank you to Daniel, Dean Shibley, and all our panelists. Thank you, everyone, for coming tonight and engaging in this conversation. To wrap up with closing remarks, I would like to invite my board chair and the president and CEO of Independent Health, Dr. Michael Kropp, to join us for the closing remarks. Thank you.
An embarrassing day after follow. Justin and readjust the microphone. Anyway, it's exciting to see everybody here tonight and great to hear so many insights about the opportunities that we have. As Justin said, I work with him on the board of Green Options Buffalo, and we're an organization that's committed to making Buffalo one of the most bike-friendly cities in the country over the next few years. You might ask, well, you know, why is he doing this? Well, I bike personally. I love it. I spend as much of my free time on my bike as I can, but this is something that's much more important to me than just my own personal pleasure. You know, I'm in healthcare, and everybody knows that healthcare is the major challenge facing the entire country today. And I hate to bring out this scary fact, but if the trend in healthcare costs that's current today were to continue forward for the next 10 years, 10 years from now, the cost to take care of an average American family of four would be about two-thirds of that average American's gross income. Completely unsustainable. And how does that tie back to biking? Well, what we know is today 70% of the costs that we spend in taking care of people are related to chronic diseases, many of which are preventable or manageable by making better personal choices about exercising, about what we eat, whether we smoke or not, how much we drink, those kinds of things. And the biggest opportunity we have is to give people more time, more opportunity to exercise. And making our community more accessible for walking and biking is a key factor in making that happen. So there's a study done by Kaiser that says 30 minutes of walking a day makes a huge difference in your overall health status. So you don't have to be outrageous in terms of your commitment. But many of us in the city don't have access to facilities, don't have access to safe environments, and we have an obligation to make that happen for all of the residents of our community. So, you know, this is more than recreation. This is about making a wonderfully livable community and making it a healthier community with the healthcare economics under control so that the community can prosper, not just physically, but economically too. So thank you all for coming, and I hope we'll see many of you back tomorrow. Thanks.